This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
There is something holy about life. It's such a freakish development in the universe. It has this astonishing capacity to fly directly in the face of entropy.
John Perry Barlow, Grateful Dead lyricist, co-founder of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, and environmentalist, died in his sleep this past week at the age of 70 after a lengthy illness. I had the honor of meeting and interviewing Mr. Barlow for Sea Change Radio a couple of times, and this week we pay tribute to him by revisiting those discussions. Among other things, he talks about his time with the Grateful Dead, his conservative Wyoming roots, and potential energy solutions for the next generation. Listen now as we remember the man who provided the words to the soundtrack for so many millions of music listeners, fought for civil liberties in the digital age, and made the world a far more interesting place. First, let's hear part of my discussion with John Perry Barlow from the fall of 2010. Welcome to Sea Change Radio, John Perry.
I'm glad to be here.
This is a program where we try to answer the question, what's next? You've been called a futurist, at least somebody who likes to think about what's next as well. What do you see on the horizon in terms of energy and the environment?
I've been accused of being a futurist. I tend to think of myself as a presentist. I predict the present, which might sound like a fool's errand, except for the fact that most people are busy predicting the past. You know, when I look at the present, in the near term, you know, we have several major problems here that have to be addressed, one of which is climate change. And I'm not even going to get into the debate about whether or not that's an issue. It is an issue. You know, it drives us to also confront another pressing problem, which is that we've been running most of our industrial systems and, you know, large-scale human support systems as though everything was an open-ended linear continuum. You know, we take resources out of one end and we spit waste out the other, as though, you know, we were getting the resources from one planet and putting the waste someplace else. But that isn't how it is. And much of what we think of as waste is actually a resource if it's properly configured, which is how you have to look at it in a spacecraft. So that's one really central issue. Also, we have water problems on this planet that I think are going to be very shortly a central human concern. And our capacity for being in denial about this is really quite sublime. I mean, we have drawn down what had been an enormous storage in Lake Mead, for example, and in fact, the whole Colorado River drainage, using water that just basically wasn't there, and doing so mostly by abrogating our treaties with Mexico and abrogating understandings between various states, so that Los Angeles has been just this unbelievable suckhole in the desert, to taking water that it didn't legally have, and also Phoenix and much of Central Arizona has been doing the same thing, because the Mexicans haven't been in a, you know, significant political position to stop it. But
we need our golf.
Well, yeah. I mean, I remember, it's so astonishing the way we use water. I was flying out of Palm Springs several years ago and looking down at this very weird landscape that's been artificially created there, and sitting next to it, you know, an older white-haired guy, pink skin, yellow pants, I'm, you know, golfer. And I said, how many golf courses do you have down there? And he said, oh my goodness, we're so proud of that. We have 109 golf courses, or some such figure, which is pretty prodigious. And I said, well, gosh, 109 golf courses. I mean, where's the water coming from for this? And he said, oh, we got plenty of water. It's in the aquifer. And I said, well, they're pumping it out of the aquifer underneath the Palm Springs Desert. And he said, yeah. And I said, well, aquifers generally are like ancient water storage. I mean, they're not getting recharged, most of them. And he said, well, no, I don't suppose this one is either, but we've got at least another 100 years of water in it. And he said 100 years like that was all the time the human race needed.
At least he needs.
Well, it certainly was way more than he needed. But, you know, and beyond his contemporary golfing needs, he didn't seem to care about it much. And
100 years is thrown around pretty cavalierly by a lot of people talking about resource depletion. You live in Wyoming, which is one of the largest deposits of coal in the planet.
Why, we've got 100 years of coal in Wyoming alone.
So nothing to worry about.
Not a thing to worry about. That's just crazy talk. And we just have to be much more thoughtful about how we go about being part of the natural ecology of planet Earth ourselves, since we are the dominant ecological force at this point in the life of the planet.
You say you're a presentist, and I thought of the lyric from Throwing Stones, where you say, the future's here, we are it, we're on our own.
That's correct. And the future is here. As my friend Bill Gibson says, the future's here is just unevenly distributed.
Can you tell our listeners a little bit more about your personal evolution? In the 70s, you were a little bit more of the conservative branch of the Grateful Dead family. But were you raised with conservative values? And this
I was
is
raised
something...
with very, I mean, I'm from Wyoming, you know. I was raised in a political family, which was a very conservative Republican family. You know, I'll pay for this in hell, no doubt. But I mean, I was one of Dick Cheney's campaign managers when he ran for Congress first time. Being raised on a ranch and growing up in a place where nature is dominant over man, generally speaking, one of the few that's left, I had a ringside seat for watching how nature worked.
What I don't understand, though, is when I hear about people who live in these places that are pristine and value the planet, conservatism should mean conservation, and somehow they've strayed very far from each other.
There is absolutely nothing conservative about wanting to use all the resources of the planet in 100 years. I mean, you know, conservative contains right at the heart of it the word conserve. I mean, there it is. Whereas I was just utterly against any kind of market intervention on the part of the government at one point. To be honest, I think growing up, I just assumed that there was a limitless supply of energy, which if you're living in Wyoming would, you know, is an easy delusion to form, because it just seemed like they were finding more of it all the time. When I first came back to the ranch after college and, you know, going off and being a hippie and going to India and starting to, you know, associate myself with the Grateful Dead, the Atomic Energy Commission and El Paso Natural Gas were in the process of trying to do a nuclear stimulation of a gas field right south of my little town in Wyoming. They wanted to set off 500 kiloton nuclear devices, as they called them, right under Pinedale, Wyoming, to shatter this large sandstone structure that was full of methane. And, you know, I started looking at the figures of methane production, because they were saying, well, you know, we could really increase the methane yield of this structure, which was too tightly bound. And we could, you know, have at least 60, 70 years of abundant methane coming out of this field. Well, you know, that was something that started to eat at me, that, you know, they thought that that was a long time, you know, particularly in view of the fact that the methane, the methane would be radioactive for at least 160 years.
Well, your songs reflect, you can see the evolution in your thinking and being more proactive with environmental issues. Which led which in terms of, did you decide as the Grateful Dead became more and more popular that this was a great soapbox for you to get your messages across, or was it?
I tried never to preach with my songs anyway. Bob Hunter and I realized sometime in the 70s that what seemed to be gathering itself naturally around the Grateful Dead was something that had many of the characteristics of a religion. And that made us uneasy. And then, you know, we thought about it some, and then thought what really made us uneasy about religion was dogma, you know, and the capacity to have a belief system you could impose on somebody else. And if there was going to be dogma in the mysterious religion of the Deadheads, it was going to come most likely from our songs. So we were very scrupulous about not giving them the opportunity to form anything out of those songs, you know, and not being preachy and not having the substrate of a belief system that they could then develop that had some sort of authoritative point of reference. But anyway, so I was never particularly didactic with my songwriting, and I had a growing set of beliefs about nature that were important to me. And, you know, and also in a spiritual sense, an awareness that everything is alive. To me it is, and that there is something holy about life. It's such a freakish development in the universe. It has this astonishing capacity to fly directly in the face of entropy.
And somehow that becomes preachy to some people, but it's reality.
It's demonstrable. If you start saying things about what life wants, besides more, you know, I mean, the motto of life, as far as I can tell, is more.
Right. You say in, is it We Can Run, the song?
We can run, but we can't hide. Yeah.
Brad Midler, you say, we got everyone believing that more is more.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it isn't. You know, I mean, more. If everything is thinking more, you know, it's a damn good thing that you know, in the complex interaction of all living things, there are other versions of more that your more is going to run up against, you know, and then there's a balance struck, and that's why life works with these very simple algorithms operating, is because they run into each other and they balance out.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. Next, let's tune into our 2016 interview with John Perry Barlow, who passed away last week at the age of 70. You've been ill for quite some time. For all your fans who listen to your songs religiously, what happened to you? Walk us through the last year for us, if you can.
Well, it's amazing what happened to me 8 months ago. I spent a day tromping around Atlanta Airport after one of those storms that leaves the place in a complete hairball, and going from gate to gate trying to find a plane and a crew and a gate that all matched up, with a new pair of boots. And I got a blister in those boots in my toe, into which there entered a staphylococcus infection that got into my bloodstream, and I had a septic condition that settled into the arthritic cartilage of my joints. And I went to Stanford Hospital, and I knew what it was. I told them what it was, because I'd experienced this before. It was only in one joint at that point. And then they sent me home. They said, well, it's not any big deal. You don't have a fever, so it's probably not an infection. I just ignored my entreaties to check me out thoroughly. And 2 days later, 3 days later, it had managed to involve all my major joints. And I had a friend who was in charge of the emergency room up here at San Francisco General, which is a pretty rough assignment. She came down and looked at me and said, well, you're dying. And so I got surgery, but it was pretty ham-handed. It was not well done. And they also failed to recognize that I had an additional infection that was in a fusion in my back. A previous fusion, the hardware had been fused back in 2007. And so I was having an enormous amount of back pain, which they attributed to God knows what. So then they found me a troubling case to deal with. So they sent me out to a rehab center in Palo Alto that was clearly designed just to milk your insurance company. I mean, that was all they were doing there. And the infection by that time had entered the marrow of my bones, and I was no longer producing any red blood cells, so my hemoglobin had gone down to basically a fatal level. And it's going to be a while before I learn how to walk again, using basically different muscles and different nerves, and I'll get her done, but it's just a long, slow climb.
And how did it feel when you were in the hospital, being connected through social media?
I was pretty out of the loop, except for the fact that one of my purposes in life, one of my central purposes in life, has been to learn how to accept love. And I was finding this continuous and genuine outpouring of love that was coming at me through Facebook, through Twitter, through email. And it was like attending my own funeral. It was really wonderful. And I swear, I think that had a lot to do with my survival, which was under threat from hospitalization throughout. I mean, you know, the third leading cause of death in the United States is iatrogenic failure, that is medically caused death. It's 180,000 people a year. And, you know, it's statistically much, much safer to be a special forces soldier in the mountains of Afghanistan than it is to be in a hospital. And I had another experience in there that was truly amazing. At one point, they installed a filter in my vena cava so as to prevent blood clots from getting up into my lungs. And they were mucking about inside my circulatory system and dislodged a clot which found its way into my coronary artery. I mean, I've never had any evidence of heart disease. You could drive a truck through my coronary artery normally. But it found its way into my coronary artery and stopped my heart dead for 8 minutes, which is a long time to be dead. And they applied the paddles once and nothing happened. And they turned up the juice and did it again and nothing happened. And finally they hit me so hard that it burned the skin on my chest. And then, and nothing happened. And then this enterprising angel of a resident yanked me off the gurney onto the floor and jumped on my chest with both knees and cracked all my ribs. But my heart sort of coughed and said, well, all right, if you're going to do that, I'll start back up.
And do you remember anything from being out for those 8 minutes?
I'd like to say I did. I was very disappointed not to see upswelling rivers of light or the great spiritual beings coming down to greet me or anything like that. It was just dark. It was nothing. Bobby Weir, I told him about this. And he said, well, maybe you weren't dead enough.
Evidently. You picked a unfortunate year to get sick with the Grateful Dead's reunion and the Fare Thee Well tours. What did that feel like, missing out on?
Oh, it was really awful. I mean, in fact, at one point, we had worked up a way for me to go to one of the concerts in San Carlos. Even my back surgeon was going to go with me. I had a couple of nurses. They had a skybox reserved for my use. They had an ambulette that they were paying for. And some official, I don't know, somewhere in the upper reaches of the management at UCSF just nixed it. It was like being told I couldn't go to the funeral of my mother. It was really tough. ¶¶
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. Now more from our 2016 interview with John Perry Barlow, Grateful Dead lyricist and the co-founder of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, who passed away last week at the age of 70.
One thing that I wanted to talk to you about since we last spoke on Sea Change Radio was Edward Snowden and privacy rights. And as you see presidential candidates in this circus that goes on and everybody mentioning where they stand on Edward Snowden, where they stand on the whistleblower concept, what does your experience as the founder of one of the co-founders of the Electronic Frontier Foundation and somebody who's been a staunch advocate for privacy rights take from not the Edward Snowden case, but the reaction from the political class?
Well, we're in a huge war between the forces of secrecy and proprietary information and establishing power by limiting access, and what I believe is the inalienable human right to know everything that is relevant to what's going on in that person's life. I mean, they have now established the right or the ability to see everything we do, everything. And I am comfortable with that if I can see everything they're doing. Because I don't, you know, if I can see everything they're doing, I can probably do something about it if I don't like it.
Which is what they're afraid of, I guess.
Well, I mean, what they're mostly afraid of is that we will see their incompetence. I mean, because I do consulting to the NSA and the CIA and have for years. And they are amazingly incompetent. The CIA hasn't called a single thing, major thing, right in its entire history. They missed everything, whether it was the Chinese crossing the Yalu or 9/11 or the fall of the wall.
Or Mossadegh in Iran.
Yes. They just don't get it. And it's very frustrating. But I, you know, my biggest concern is that what we've created is what Ed Snowden calls turnkey totalitarianism, where I basically trust the people who are presently running the intelligence agencies not to abuse them, but they could be supplanted by other people with a cultural or political agenda, people who want to use that power to impose Sharia in the sense of all the principles of fundamental Christianity and continuing the ongoing war between the 50s and the 60s with a huge upper hand of the 50s, that could happen. So I'm interested in anything that makes them more visible. And at one point, WikiLeaks was really squeaking for money, and EFF didn't want to pass through funds to them. They felt there was a chance of being named as aiding and abetting terrorism. And I finally decided that we just needed to set up something using people that were basically fearless. So I called up Dan Ellsberg and John Cusack and several other folks and started the Freedom of the Press Foundation, which has this marvelous way of kind of laundering money in the sense that donations come in to the Freedom of the Press Foundation, and there's a slider which has four different organizations or causes that it can be devoted to, one of which being WikiLeaks. So, you know, we've been very successful in getting a lot of money for not only WikiLeaks, but also something called Secure Drop, which Aaron Schwartz was working on when he died. And Secure Drop is a very secure method of maintaining complete anonymity while informing somebody from the media about something that needs to be generally known. And that's been installed by the New York Times, the Guardian, the New Yorker, a bunch of Washington Post, a bunch of big outlets. Well, also on our board was Glenn Greenwald and Laura Poitras, who had not met each other before they got on our board and became an incredibly important part of bringing Ed Snowden to light.
And Citizen Four.
Yeah. And furthermore, the money that we provided WikiLeaks was then used to get Ed out of Hawaii and to Hong Kong, and then from Hong Kong to Moscow, and, you know, getting all this done with sufficient cover. And Ed is now on the board of Freedom of the Press Foundation.
Is he living still in limbo in Russia?
He's living in limbo in Russia. I mean, he's got his girlfriend there with him, which is much nicer. And he does get out. I was talking to him the other day, and he was talking about how much he liked the subway. I think he'd a lot rather be in the United States.
Do you think there's a chance that the political environment will allow for that?
God, I don't know. I mean, there's otherwise intelligent people in the intelligence agencies are just completely intractable on this subject. I mean, I've tried really hard. I mean, I know very highly placed people, and Ed is really one of the most lucid, persuasive, decent, clear-minded human beings I've ever met.
You get that feeling from the movie.
No, it is. He's an astonishing person, and could do more to reform those institutions than anybody ever has, which is precisely what they fear. And I can't get anybody to talk to him. I mean, any of the highly placed officials. They tell me that if they talk to him, they'll lose their security clearance. Now, how much sense does that make?
John Perry Barlow, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Samford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by The Grateful Dead.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.